In September 1939, the Liberty piece hit the newsstands. It was a bit lurid, and we thought the title, Alcoholics and God, would scare off plenty of prospects. Maybe it did, but several hundred alcoholics and their families were not scared. Liberty magazine received 800 urgent pleas for help, which were promptly turned over to Ruth and me. She wrote fine personal letters to every one of them, enclosing a leaflet which described the AA book. The response was wonderful. Several hundred books sold at once, at full retail price of $3.50. Even more importantly, we struck up a correspondence with alcoholics, their friends, and their families all over the country. Ruth could at last draw a few dollars a week for herself. And all those moving appeals for assistance had made us forget our own troubles. Looking after all those new people by mail and relating them, in some cases, to each other and in others to the groups in Akron, New York, and Cleveland became our chief occupation until early 1940. Shortly after the Liberty article came out, Cleveland's Plain Dealer ran its great series of pieces, as already described. This brought in new book orders and new problems by scores. Alcoholics Anonymous was on the march, out of its infancy into adolescence. As noted earlier, Lois and I moved to the home of Bob and Mag in Muncie, New York, to spend the winter of 1939 and the early spring of 1940. A little after this, we moved to a friend's apartment in New York City, then briefly to a room in Greenwich Village, and finally to AA's first clubhouse, the Old 24th, where we remained until the spring of 1941. The contributors to the Lois W. Home Replacement Fund kept up their good work. Thus, we were comfortable enough, and our happiness grew as we watched AA unfold. One sad incident marred the early spring of 1940. Not knowing where any of us might live in the future, we had chosen Box 658 at one of New York's downtown post offices as the most central point of the whole metropolitan area, Long Island and New Jersey included. It now seemed right for us to establish a small office near this box. Backed by the book stockholders and by Ruth, I made this proposal. Henry, whose job took him into western New Jersey, objected violently. He wanted to take the book business and Ruth wherever he went. His job was not going too well, and he was on what we nowadays call a dry bender. The more we insisted, the more adamant and violent he became. He was heavily beset with other problems, too. At length, he broke down completely and went on a terrific bender after 4 years of sobriety. He never again showed any real sign of recovery, and he went on drinking until his death recently. Considering what he had done for the book, and the further fact that he was one of our first New York members, this was hard to take. My own sponsor, Ebby, also continued his drinking and hadn't as yet shown any desire to stop. Our whole group shivered, and we asked ourselves, if stalwarts like these can relapse, what is going to become of the rest of us? Actually, though, the effect was to make each one of us more vigilant. So no wave of slips followed in the wake of poor Henry's collapse. Our expansion had been immensely accelerated by the Liberty piece and the frantic growth at Cleveland. Tiny beginnings had been made in many other towns and cities, which we denoted by placing pins on our office wall map. By early 1940, we could estimate that about 800 recoveries had been made. This number was a big jump from the figure of 100 at the time the book was published in April of the year before. The book had expressed the hope that someday AA travelers would find a group at every destination. That hope had begun to turn into reality. All through the uncertain year of 1939, our non-alcoholic friends of the Board of Trustees had stayed with us. Another New York AA member, Bill R., had been made a trustee, and Mr. A. Leroy Chipman, who had been keeping an eye on us all along, now joined up himself and became the Foundation's treasurer. Nevertheless, the treasury itself was just as empty as before. In 1940, we saw the establishment of the first clubhouse and the opening of the first rest farm. The New York groupers had been complaining that weekly meetings in a rented parlor at Steinway Hall were not enough. We had to be together more. We needed something homelike, maybe a club. The idea caught on, and two of the elders, Howard and Bert, promptly spotted just the thing at 334 and a half West 24th Street and personally guaranteed the rent. Tom B., another stalwart, did the same thing for the club's light, heat, and telephone. Originally, the club building had been a stable in the backyards of two brick houses. It opened onto the street by a narrow, covered-over alley. Years earlier, the horses had given way to artists who had paneled the place and trimmed it up nicely. The quarters had become too small for the Illustrators Club, so they moved out, and we AAs moved in. The lower floor could hold a fair-sized meeting. The upper floor had a recreation room and two tiny bedrooms. One of these was soon to house Old Tom, our famous first caretaker. And shortly thereafter, Lois and I moved into the other one to stay for about a year. Our association there with others like Herb and Isla, Bobby and Dick, Wilbur and Ruth, Henry and Lillian, and many another will always be unforgettable. Of course, the club promptly had its own peculiar troubles, just as hundreds of others have since had. But like most AA clubs, this first one did us far more good than harm, especially after we learned that the club had to be on the sidelines and could not be managed by the AA groups as such. The old 24th Street Club witnessed much of AA's early history. Still in busy operation, it is now a landmark visited by members from all over the world. Similar and far larger clubs were started in Philadelphia and Minneapolis later in 1940. Scores and scores of clubrooms and clubhouses now dot our landscape. Some of the more elegant ones, especially those in Texas, have to be seen to be believed. Meanwhile, up in the hills of Connecticut, an interesting development had been taking place. A group of farms there belonged to a dear lady affectionately known to countless AAs as Sister Frances. This wonderfully good soul, out of her own pocket, had operated these farms as a series of charities, one for the aged, one for children, and one for any wayfarer who passed by. In the summer of 1939, our New York member Marty had sponsored a prospect called Nona W. Nona, one of AA's first women, had already enjoyed the farm's hospitality and eagerly conducted a party of us to Connecticut, where we met Sister Frances. That good lady had fallen on hard times, and only one farm remained. She called it the Ministry of the High Watch. Sister Frances seemed to be delighted with us as we were with her. She offered us full use of the place if some of us would create a board of trustees to look after it. Laughingly, she has since admitted that she was shocked as well as captivated by her early alcoholic visitors. Until then, she reflected, the greatest scandal in her family had been the time when in Rome, her sister was seen in company of an Italian army officer without a chaperone. But Sister Frances made a ready adjustment to us. With each passing year, we AAs have loved her more, and she has returned our affection. The Rest Farm, which has come into being as a result of Sister Frances's gift, is a charming place, which, with its cabins, can accommodate more than 20 guests. It is a wonderful spot to send anyone who needs extra time to recuperate after hospitalization, and many AAs use it for vacations. Similar retreats can be found today throughout the length and breadth of our fellowship. Though they are not strictly AA enterprises, they do give many of us fine support and refreshment. On behalf of everyone, I here set down our gratitude to Sister Frances and her much-altered Ministry of the High Watch. At the February 1940 meeting, Uncle Dick Richardson turned up beaming and mysterious. Presently, he broke the news that Mr. John D. Rockefeller, Jr., who had not been heard from since 1937, had been following our progress with intense interest. Mr. Rockefeller had decided that he wanted to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous. He proposed a dinner meeting to which he would invite several hundred of his own friends and acquaintances so that they might glimpse the beginnings of our remarkable fellowship. Uncle Dick produced the list of the people who were invited. It contained some 400 names, a veritable constellation of New York's prominent and wealthy. Anybody could see that their total financial worth might easily be $1 billion. To us alcoholics, it appeared that Mr. Rockefeller had at last changed his mind and that our money troubles would soon be a thing of the past. At this point, we were comforted to learn that Dick Richardson's fundraising friend, Mr. Carlton Sherwood, had been using his influence and good offices to bring about this promising prospect. There is a reference to Mr. Rockefeller's dinner earlier in this book, but I think that a fuller description of that memorable event ought to go into our records. For this was the moment at which AA's tradition of declining outside contributions began to take definite shape and form. On the evening of February 8, 1940, the dinner party foregathered at the Union Club in New York, a club even more conservative than the Union League itself. Some 75 of the 400 who were invited turned up. They looked like a fine lot of men. But as they gathered in the dining hall, most of them did wear rather puzzled expressions. Obviously, they could not quite make out what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. A few feared that AA was another scheme to dry up the whole world, and said so. To take care of any questions, we had planted a New York AA member at each table. During dinner, this thawed things out in a hurry. There were many queries, and some of our answers amazed the notables. At one table sat our hero Morgan, as impeccably dressed as a collar ad boy. One gray-haired banker inquired, "Mr. R., what institution are you with?" Morgan grinned and replied, "Well, sir, I'm not with any institution at the moment. 9 months ago, however, I was a patient in Greystone Asylum." The interest at that table took a sharp upturn. Dr. Bob had arrived with an Akron old-timer, Paul, and had also brought Clarence, a founder of the flourishing Cleveland Group. Dr. Russell Blaisdell, who during the previous fall had let us work with patients in his state asylum at Rockland, New York, was there, along with our good Dr. Silkworth. Dr. Bob and I were scheduled to speak. Several other alcoholics were to handle a question and answer period, and the entire proceedings were to be backed up by Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick, representing religion, and Dr. Foster Kennedy, the world-renowned neurologist who would speak for medicine. We should here take special note of these two wonderful friends. Dr. Fosdick had been the very first clergyman to recognize us. Early in 1939, he had seen the pre-publication copy of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and had at once volunteered to review it. This magnificent review, shown in the appendix of this volume, well illustrates his deep understanding and high approval of our fellowship. Likewise, Dr. Kennedy, our first friend in the field of neurology, never missed an opportunity to declare his great faith in AA. Mr. Rockefeller himself had been taken ill suddenly and could not come. His son Nelson, whom we all liked immensely, did the honors as chairman for the occasion. I was seated between Dr. Blaisdell and Nelson Rockefeller. Directly in front of me was Wendell Willkie. The dinner was squab on toast. For a bunch of ex-drunks, we were doing remarkably well. We wondered how Mr. Rockefeller had dared to go so far out on a limb for an obscure and struggling fellowship of alcoholics. After dinner, Mr. Nelson Rockefeller rose to his feet. He expressed his father's regret for being unable to attend. He told how deeply Mr. John D. Jr. had been affected by his experience with this society of Alcoholics Anonymous. Promising a highly interesting evening, Nelson Rockefeller began to introduce the speakers. Dr. Fosdick gave us a most wonderful testimonial and expressed complete confidence in our future. Dr. Kennedy warmly endorsed us and read a letter of protest he had written to the Journal of the American Medical Association because, in their review of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, they had somewhat ridiculed us. Dr. Bob spoke briefly, and I gave a rapid account of my own experience as a drinker, my recovery, and the subsequent history of our fellowship. As we watched the faces of the guests, it was evident that we had captured their sympathetic interest. Great influence and great wealth were soon to be at our disposal. Weariness and worry were to be things of the past. Finally, the big moment came. Mr. Nelson Rockefeller, visibly moved, got to his feet once more. On behalf of his father, he thanked us all for coming. He reiterated that few more affecting things than Alcoholics Anonymous had ever crossed his father's life. His father would be delighted, Nelson said, to know how many guests had availed themselves of the chance to see the beginnings of this most promising adventure of Alcoholics Anonymous. Breathlessly, we waited for the climax, the matter of money. Nelson Rockefeller obliged us. Continuing, he said, "Gentlemen, you can all see that this is a work of goodwill. Its power lies in the fact that one member carries the good message to the next without any thought of financial income or reward. Therefore, it is our belief that Alcoholics Anonymous should be self-supporting so far as money is concerned. It needs only our goodwill." Whereupon the guests clapped lustily, and after cordial handshakes and goodbyes all around, the whole $1 billion worth of them walked out the door. We were dazed. Why had Mr. Rockefeller gone to all that trouble just for this? We simply could not figure it out. But a few days later, we began to see. And as time passes, Alcoholics Anonymous sees ever more clearly what he meant and what he did. Dick Richardson had transcripts of all the talks that had been made at the dinner, and he asked me to condense and edit them. This really meant editing Dr. Bob and me, for who would edit Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick and Dr. Foster Kennedy? Dick said that Mr. Rockefeller wanted to buy 400 books, and we let him have them at a whopping discount, too, $1 each. He wanted to send one to every guest on the dinner list, along with a pamphlet containing the talks given at the dinner. And Mr. Rockefeller planned to write each dinner guest a personal letter, a copy of which would be presently shown us. Mr. Rockefeller's letter, which was addressed to all who came to the dinner, as well as to those who did not, reiterated his high confidence in Alcoholics Anonymous. The satisfaction he had in knowing that many of his friends had witnessed the start of a movement of such great promise, and his deep conviction that our society ought to be self-supporting. He followed this with a statement to the effect that a little temporary help might be needed. He, therefore, was giving Alcoholics Anonymous $1,000. In all probability, this was a mild hint that the other diners might contribute modestly if they so wished. Despite the curiosity of the press, no reporters had been allowed at the dinner. This was understandable, for Mr. Rockefeller was certainly taking chances. Had any of us alcoholics turned up stewed, the whole affair would have collapsed ignominiously. But as soon as it was seen that all had gone well, we were put in touch with the firm of Ivy Lee, Mr. Rockefeller's publicity consultants, and together we drafted a statement to the press. The ensuing publicity was favorable and widespread. The news wires carried the news of Mr. Rockefeller's dinner all over the world. A few of the stories that appeared were somewhat lurid and ran under startling headlines. One headline informed the public, "John D. Rockefeller dines tosspots." But all the stories plugged AA just the same. Even the tabloids gave us the glad hand. The total effect was to give Alcoholics Anonymous a public status of dignity and worth. Thus encouraged, considerable numbers of people went to their bookstores to buy the AA book. Orders poured in, and our financial difficulties were much eased. Hundreds of requests for help came from alcoholics and their families all over the nation. These names were added to our growing list of correspondents that we hoped to reach later by personal contact as our fellowship grew. The awful letdown which had followed the departure of the dinner guests was now forgotten. At about this time, our trusteeship began to be enlarged. Mr. Robert Shaw, a lawyer and friend of Uncle Dick's, was elected to the board. Two New Yorkers, my friends Howard and Bert, were also named. As time passed, these were joined by Tom B. and Dick S. Dick had been one of the original Akronites who was now living in New York. There was also Tom K., a hard-working and conservative Jersey man. Somewhat later, more non-alcoholics, notably Bernard Smith and Leonard Harrison, took up their long season of service with us. The Board of Trustees conceived the idea of soliciting the dinner guests for contributions. Since Mr. Rockefeller had made a token gift of $1,000, it was supposed that the solicitation would not have any large money result, but it certainly might help. Mr. Rockefeller consented, and an appeal was directed to the dinner list. As we expected, no contribution was large, but the donations were fairly numerous. The smallest check was for $10, and the highest was for $300 from a gentleman who had an alcoholic brother. The total of these gifts amounted to about $2,000, and this, plus Mr. Rockefeller's gift of $1,000, put our hitherto empty foundation in funds for the first time. Money-wise, Dr. Bob and I were still in a rather bad way. We were therefore allotted $30 a week, and enough was on hand to keep this up for a year. Thereafter, the dinner guests were solicited annually, and the proceeds were always divided in the same way. 4 years later, we were able to write Mr. Rockefeller and his friends at the Union Club dinner that we needed no more funds. By then, royalties from the book were giving Dr. Bob and me the help we needed, and the AA groups had begun to pick up the load of supporting the headquarters office. At that point, the AA tradition of no outside contributions went into full force and effect. Mr. Rockefeller and his friends had given us something more valuable than money. They had put AA on the map. Now, to flash back for a moment to the spring of 1940. Over Henry's strong objections, we had moved from the tiny cubicle of an office in New York to one slightly larger at 30 Vesey Street, New York City, next door to our downtown post office box. Ruth and I set about answering the massive inquiries that came in the wake of the Rockefeller dinner and the resulting publicity. Many new AA groups took shape as travelers from the older centers, armed with lists of prospects, visited new locations. The struggles at these distant outposts were quickly reflected in letters asking for advice on the growing pains and problems of the new groups. Almost every week, we happily added a new pin to our wall map to mark another group in formation. The sales of the AA book steadily increased, and we could now meet the cost of rent, postage, and supplies. And, best of all, we could pay Ruth a fair salary. Lois and I were living rent-free at the old 24th Street Club, and we were able to get along nicely on the proceeds of the Rockefeller dinner and gifts still being made to the Lois W. Home Replacement Fund in the foundation. Everybody began to breathe easier. The affairs of Works Publishing, however, were still in pretty sketchy shape. It had never been incorporated, and the only evidence of its existence were the stock certificates that Henry and I had manufactured, the books in the warehouse, and the canceled checks that gave a rough idea of how the money had been spent. 400 shares of stock, to be equally divided between Henry and me, had never been issued and could not be issued under our original agreement until the cash subscribers had received all their money back. When they heard that the book was making money, some of the cash subscribers, including even Charlie Towns, began to get restless. They wanted to know why all the profits of the book were being spent to finance a headquarters for AA. We replied that there was not any other way. Would they like to see all those pleas for help thrown in the wastebasket? But a few still insisted on getting their money back, and something had to be done. Therefore, Ruth and I set about making Works Publishing's first report to its stockholders. We outlined the history of the book project and painted a rosy picture for the future. From the mass of check stubs, old bills, and receipts, we made an approximate accounting. As I remember, the publishing company had shown a profit of about $3,000, which had all been spent on AA work at the office. Again, we turned to our trusted pad of blank stock certificates. On a number of these, we wrote, Works Publishing Incorporated, Preferred Stock, par value $100. Equipped with these certificates, I went off to Washington. The new AA group there included some well-to-do members, Bill E., Hardin C., and Bill A. They cheerfully bought these strange and irregular stock certificates in the amount of about $3,000. Thus, we satisfied a few of the grumbling stockholders and gratefully handed to Mr. Charles Townes all of the money which he had advanced to make the book project possible. He was delighted, and so were we. In this period, one of our non-alcoholic friends performed an outstanding service for us. This was Accountant West of West Flint and Company, a lifelong associate of Dick Richardson. He saw that Works Publishing was properly incorporated, and he personally audited its affairs and those of the foundation from our beginnings in 1938. Ruth had had no time to keep books, and I did not know how. So a thorough CPA audit of the book company proved to be a real job. The tireless Mr. West spent days and days at it without pay. When this difficult job of unscrambling our affairs was completed, we felt we could ask no more of Mr. West. From that point on, Wilbur S., a CPA, as well as an early AA, took over the job of keeping our records in shape. He did this for a long time, gratis, and even today, I doubt if we pay him enough. By 1940, we had begun to see that the AA book should belong to our society itself. Its shares should not be forever scattered among 49 subscribers, Ruth Hawk, Henry, and me. If the foundation could acquire these outstanding shares, the book could be placed in trust for AA as a whole. The proceeds of the book would become tax-free if the cash shareholders were paid off and they could no longer kick about the book's income being used to run the AA office. Trustee A. Leroy Chipman conceived the idea of borrowing enough money from Mr. Rockefeller, two of his sons, and the dinner guests to clear away certain debts and to buy all Works Publishing shares, except Henry's and mine, from the cash subscribers at par. Every one of the cash subscribers gladly consented to this. They were happy to get out even. Mr. Chipman thereupon raised a total of $8,000 to be repaid to Mr. Rockefeller and the others out of book profits at a later date. The subscribers turned in their shares, received their money, and placed our foundation in possession of a one-third interest in Works Publishing. A few of the subscribers, both alcoholic and non-alcoholic, were extra generous. Some sent all and some half of the money they had received back to the foundation as gifts. That left two-thirds interest in Works Publishing still coming to Henry and me. Seeing the necessity of the situation, I agreed to turn my 200 shares over to the foundation. But poor Henry, still drinking, was not easily convinced. For a long time, he resisted all our pleas. One day, completely broke and very shaky, he turned up at the VC Street office. He pointed out that most of our office furniture still belonged to him, particularly the huge desk and the overstuffed chair. This gave us an idea. Supposing we said that the foundation would buy his furniture for, say, $200, would he then turn his Works Publishing stock over to the trustees? Henry finally consented and signed the necessary paper, promising to do this. As a matter of fact, we had once before allowed Henry money on his furniture in order to help him out. But the trustees gravely produced still another $200. Henry turned in his stock. I turned in mine, and that is how the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous, through its trustees, came to own the big book. There was a slow but steady growth of our society during 1940. As new groups were started, local newspapers began to print articles about this strange new fellowship. These pieces helped us greatly. Lois and Ruth each had started scrapbooks, and they happily pasted up the clippings as they came in. Groups were well underway in big towns like Boston, Philadelphia, Detroit, Chicago, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, and many smaller towns had equally promising beginnings. Cleveland continued its phenomenal boom, which had begun the year before. The New York clubhouse could hardly seat its meetings. In Akron, Dr. Bob had begun the historic partnership with Sister Ignatia in St. Thomas Hospital. Thus, AA rolled along until the spring of 1941, when we could count 2,000 members, a gain of 1,200 in a single year. We thought this was good going, but actually we had not seen anything yet. We were on the threshold of the event that made Alcoholics Anonymous a national institution overnight. Dr. A. Weishammer, already champion of AA in Philadelphia, had drawn our fellowship to the attention of Curtis Bach, one of the owners of the Saturday Evening Post. At first, the editorial board of the Post was dubious. But Mr. Bach had seen some of our Philadelphia members and had heard about their recovery at first hand. He knew whereof he spoke. And the next thing we knew, Mr. Jack Alexander, a star feature writer for the Post, appeared at our VC Street office. Knowing the circulation and prestige of the Saturday Evening Post, we were thrown into great excitement. Jack is an excellent reporter, and he by no means went overboard at once. The smell and taste of the Jersey rackets, which he had just been investigating, were still fresh to him. Seeing this, we gave him the most exhaustive briefing on Alcoholics Anonymous any writer has ever had. First, he met our trustees and New York people, and then we towed him all over the country. Finally, Jack said that he had had enough. He was ready to write. But a serious difficulty arose. The Saturday Evening Post wanted pictures. Indeed, it said it must have them. It was all right, they said, for Dr. Bob, myself, and other alcoholics to be called by other than their real names, but pictures they had to have, and some of them had to be on the sensational side. We objected that this might keep people away. Finally, the Post said, "No pictures, no article." The choice was ours, and it was a hard one. Over the protests of a good many conservative and fearful members, we told the Post to go ahead. It was a crucial decision, which happily turned out to be the right one. That is, for the time being. The article appeared in the March 1, 1941 issue. Jack's extensive investigation and his remarkable capacity for sympathy and rapport with us produced a piece which had immense impact. By mail and telegram, a deluge of pleas for help and orders for the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, first in hundreds and then in thousands, hit Box 658. Ruth and I laughed as we remembered the day less than 2 years before when the postal clerk had handed us those jeering postcards from the doctors. Pawing at random through the incoming mass of heartbreaking appeals, we found ourselves crying. What on earth could we do with them? We were really swamped. We saw that we must have help. So we rounded up every AA woman and every AA wife who could use a typewriter. The upper floor of the 24th Street Club was converted into an emergency headquarters. For days, Ruth and the volunteers tried to answer the ever-increasing tide of mail. They were almost tempted into using form letters, but experience had shown that this would not do at all. A warm, personal communication must be sent to every prospect and his family. The peak of the flood finally passed, but the regular correspondence traffic through headquarters remained so great that we saw we would have to have permanent paid help. Volunteers could not handle the situation. We also realized that these increased demands upon the office could not be met out of book income. So, for the first time, we asked the AA groups to help. Following the Post piece, Trustees Howard and Burt went on the road, one to Philadelphia and Washington, the other to Akron and Cleveland. They asked that all AA groups contribute to a special fund in the foundation, which would be earmarked for AA office expenses only. The contributions would be entirely voluntary. As a measuring stick, it was suggested that each group send in $1 per member per year. Gradually, group funds began to trickle in, and we were able to add 2 regular paid workers to the staff. The AA tradition of self-support began to be a reality. The net book income could now go into the foundation. Whenever the groups failed to meet office expenses, this reserve fund could plug the deficit, as it frequently did for many years. The book Alcoholics Anonymous was not only helping to save alcoholics, it became the financial cornerstone of the headquarters and the guarantor of our solvency. At the end of 1941, when the group secretaries made their reports, we found that the membership had jumped to 8,000, an increase of 6,000 over 1940. We had begun to reach into Canada and into foreign lands. Everywhere we were growing rapidly. In many ways, 1941 can be reckoned as the most exciting year in our history. We paid little attention to the low-lying clouds on the horizon, which would soon involve us in storms. AA was just entering its fearful and wonderful time of adolescence, a phase which was to last almost 15 years. The pins on our office wall map showed scores of new groups springing up every week. Sometimes experienced AAs moved away from established centers to make their homes in other cities. Such localities were the lucky ones. But in most cases, the newly formed groups had no experience guidance whatever, except for the AA book, an occasional traveler, and correspondence with headquarters. Their worries and problems seemed endless. Committees quarreled, new clubs had unheard-of headaches, orators held forth, groups split wide open. Some members turned professional, selling AA therapy for money to new prospects. Sometimes whole groups got drunk, and local public relations went haywire. Such was the beginning of a truly frightening experience that lasted a long time. Then, in one of our larger centers, the amazing story got around that the foundation and the New York office and the book Alcoholics Anonymous were nothing but a huge racket for which Mr. John D. Rockefeller had foolishly fallen. At the height of this commotion, a few AAs set up a dinner in the city where these rumors had the largest currency. Dr. Bob and I were asked to speak. The dinner was not any too well attended, and the usual good cheer seemed mysteriously lacking. When the festivities were over, the chairman of all of the groups in town conducted Dr. Bob and me to a hotel parlor. There they produced an attorney and a certified public accountant. They had been hearing awful stories about the foundation. They had heard that the book Alcoholics Anonymous was making vast sums of money, that Dr. Bob and I shared profits of $64,000 the year before. They believed that I, the Wall Street promoter, had my truck backed right up to Mr. John D. Rockefeller's strongbox and had persuaded him to fill it with coin for me and my friends. The interrogating committee let us know that a member from their city had met one of our trustees in New York who was said to have confirmed these appalling reports. This incredible but more than half-believed fantasy hit Dr. Bob and me quite hard. Fortunately, I happened to have with me a certified audit of all of our affairs from the beginning. This showed that Dr. Bob, though he had been assigned a royalty, had never received any because his money was needed for the AA office work. He was still on a $30 a week stipend from the Rockefeller dinner. Like Dr. Bob, I received $30 a week from the dinner guests. And since the Post article, I had begun drawing $25 a week from the publishing company, which had seemed justified from the book sales. My total income was $55 a week. The foundation itself still had practically no cash balance. The group contributions coming into it were promptly spent on the office in order to carry on there. The investigating committee's accountant read our modest financial statement aloud and testified to its correctness. The committee was crestfallen, and we received an apology. The committee's chairman explained that the meeting had been called to set the record straight, that few of the committee members had actually believed the stories. He promised that he and his fellows would do all that they could to stop the spreading of these tales. But they never quite succeeded. The racket talk went on for years in that region. It was a very good experience for Dr. Bob and me. It obliged us to carefully re-examine our status and seek the counsel of friends. This was one of the test cases out of which AA's tradition respecting professionalism and paid workers was evolved. It was certain that I could not continue full-time, nor Bob devote more than half his working hours to AA unless we both had some definite source of steady income. We could not expect the dinner guests to bolster us up indefinitely. That would be contrary to the then-forming tradition of no contributions from the outside world. Neither could he and I receive group funds, which were already pledged to the support of the headquarters office. Profits of the book were all going into the Foundation Reserve Fund, and we had no business to touch them either. So royalties from the book, provided the sales ever got large enough, seemed to be the only answer to the problem. In this way, we might be recompensed for authorship and for the labor of putting the publishing company together. But would this constitute professionalism within the meaning of our growing tradition? Some members said that this would make us professionals. We would be making money out of AA. But our experience elsewhere had begun to indicate that this was not necessarily so. Our clubs were paying for caretakers, most of them AA members. They were not paid anything for their 12-step work, but they were recompensed as janitors and cooks. We simply had to have their full-time services. Our New York office had just engaged an alcoholic staff member full-time. Was she a professional AA? Obviously not. She was being paid for special services as a secretary. Ever since the book project started, my own thinking had gone from one extreme to the other. Sometimes I had felt that I should hang on to my one-third stock interest and have my royalty, too. I was entitled, I thought, to all the financial reward that my work on the book business justified. At other times, I felt that I should not take a cent, no matter what difficulties that might cause Lois and me. Shortly after the financial investigation episode, Father Ed Dowling, our Jesuit friend from St. Louis, turned up in New York. Still puzzled, I put the case up to him. He asked, "Do you think AA requires your full-time efforts?" I replied, "Yes, I think it does, perhaps indefinitely." Then he inquired, "Could you become a paid therapist taking money for 12-step work?" I told him that this issue had been settled long since. Most emphatically, I could not, regardless of the consequences, nor could any other AA member. "Well, Bill," said Father Ed, "if you were the only one concerned, you could certainly start wearing a hair shirt and take nothing. But what about Lois? Once upon a time, you made a marriage contract to support her. Suppose you put her on the charity of Friends so that you can do a service organization job for AA free. Would that be the kind of support your marriage contract called for? I should think the royalties would be the best bet." This meant that Dr. Bob and I must certainly never accept money for 12-step work, but that we could be recompensed for special services. We both accepted Father Ed's down-the-middle advice and have stuck by it ever since. And I am glad to say this status for Dr. Bob and me was later accepted as correct in principle by our entire fellowship. In early 1942, non-alcoholic secretary Ruth Hawk left us to be married, carrying the affectionate wishes of thousands of members. The work of that sturdy little pioneer of the book Alcoholics Anonymous and AA's first headquarters set us an example that will never be forgotten. She was replaced by Bobby B., who became AA's National Secretary number 2. Bobby's complete loyalty and devotion and her unbelievable energy and capacity for hard work were priceless helps during the confused and hazardous years which now lay ahead of us. Just before Ruth left, a news clipping whose content was to become famous was called to our attention by a New York member, Newsman Jack. It was an obituary notice from a New York paper. Underneath a routine account of the one who had died, there appeared these words: "God grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and wisdom to know the difference." Never had we seen so much AA in so few words. While Ruth and I were admiring the prayer and wondering how to use it, Friend Howard walked into the office. Confirming our own ideas, he exclaimed, "We ought to print this on cards and drop one into every piece of mail that goes out of here. I'll pay for the first printing." For several years afterward, we followed his suggestion, and with amazing speed, the Serenity Prayer came into general use and took its place alongside our two other favorites, the Lord's Prayer and the Prayer of St. Francis.